Hello, and welcome once again to NaturalDocRadio.com. I'm Janet Cimarelli, and as always, lots of information on your health and important information to maintain your good health. And I'm here with Dr. Herb Slavin, and today, a very far-ranging discussion, but on topics that you need to know about. Dr. Slavin?
Hi, Janet. We're going to start off talking about a problem that's really, I think, has come to be universal, and that's thyroid disease or a underacting thyroid gland.
It seems to be so common, a little bit more common among women, but Dr. Slavin, I'm sure that you see it both in men and women.
I do, and you really, when it comes to thyroid disease, you really have to go by how the patient feels. In other words, take a good history of the patient and then confirm your impression with a lab test. And that's where the problem comes in, is how do you interpret the lab tests?
Dr. Slavin, I see so many people who bring me their blood tests with regard to thyroid. And of course, sometimes I see that the blood test is seriously lacking, but other times I would view the lab test results with a little bit of an eye about what I refer to as subclinical underactive thyroid, and their doctors, whoever has been ordering the test, seems to be telling the patient, you're fine. The reason you're so sad, or the reason you're overweight or losing hair or have no energy, those are due to other issues. Do you have something to say to those patients?
Yes. The test that's typically done to evaluate thyroid disease is not as specific as it should be. So therefore, if you just look at the test as being within range or outside range, you're going to miss a lot of people with a thyroid problem. That test that was introduced in the 1970s is a TSH test, a thyroid stimulating hormone. A lot of doctors use that exclusively when they're doing a test just to screen for thyroid problems. And it's been my observation over 30 years or more that people can have thyroid issues and have a normal TSH test.
I remember being at a meeting where an endocrinologist was introducing that test, and his words were, we now have the gold standard in thyroid testing. And I remember being so excited that this really was going to be the significant test with identifying for women the source of so many of their hormonal imbalance problems. And unfortunately, it's turned out not necessarily to be true. So very, very important that people become aware of the wide range of other tests that go far beyond TSH.
There was a recent article published in the
British Medical Journal, I think it was.
Right, British Medical Journal. Was called Hypothyroidism Screening and Subclinical Disease. That means disease when people have a disease when there are no symptoms. That's what subclinical means. So the only way to know you have a problem is to do some testing for it. And that's where the problem begins. When you do testing for it, how do you interpret the test? The range for the TSH is 0.5 to 4.5. So a lot of doctors will look at that and say, okay, you're within range. We don't have to do anything about you. You don't have a thyroid problem.
So a lot of people will have, let's say, a 4.0 TSH number, and their doctor tells them, no, you don't have a thyroid problem. It isn't appropriate for me to prescribe thyroid medication. Yet those very same patients might very well have, sleep disorder, weight gain, fatigue, dry skin, hair loss. Those are some of the very common ones that I see.
So here in that article I was referring to, here are some of the criticisms of the TSH test. Number one, they say that range is much too broad. If your TSH level is above 2, you have to consider the presence of subclinical thyroid disease or hypothyroidism.
It's interesting because the article also says the TSH needs to be scrapped and medical students taught again how to clinically recognize low thyroid conditions. And so sad because so many of the physicians that my clients talk to me about, they're not acknowledging those symptoms.
Well, put a different way, this is the question the doctors are asking who published this article. Why are we following a test which has no correlation with clinical presentation? In other words, people could be sick, but the test says you're normal. What good is that test?
It's so sad for so many patients.
The thyroidologists, by consensus, have decided that the test is the most useful for following treatment when, in fact, it is unrelated to how the patient feels.
I see that over and over and over again.
Now, here's the interesting thing. When this test was first introduced in the 1970s, it changed the dosages that doctors were prescribing for patients, and it lowered them by as much as 75% because they were basing it on the test and not how the patient felt. So here's something that happened when that occurred. 6 years after they came out with the guidelines for using TSH, chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia appeared. These are both hypothyroid conditions, but because their TSH levels are normal based on this range, they've not been treated. The TSH needs to be scrapped and medical students taught, like Jana just said, how to clinically recognize low thyroid conditions. And that's why they call medicine an art. Art of medicine.
Okay, but that art of medicine seems to have been disregarded in medical school.
Well, that's true, because what they're doing is the medical school is training future pharmaceutical salespeople. Not the detail people that go to doctor's offices, but like you said, the prescriptionist, the doctor, that's going to write all these prescriptions. Now you say, well, what does that have to do with thyroid disease? Well, if you have a thyroid problem, you may be experiencing an inability to lose weight with diet or exercise. You may be putting on weight. You may feel fatigued. We mentioned that you may have hair problems. You have aches in your joints, hands, feet, pains all over. As I'm saying, reading this off, think of all the drugs that are being prescribed to treat these problems that could have been addressed by correcting a thyroid issue.
It's interesting to me because I have this paranoid perspective that possibly the pharmaceutical companies would rather sell 20 different drugs than address that one underlying condition, dysfunctional thyroid.
Is that a question or that's an observation?
It's my paranoid observation.
Exactly what it's exactly what they're doing. Here are some of the other symptoms of a dysfunctional thyroid gland. Depression. Mood changes. Now think of all the drugs being used just for those two problems right there. Difficulty concentrating is another one. Feelings of sadness. So you can see all the antidepressants being sold to people who really have a thyroid problem. Memory issues. Do people complain? I'm more forgetful lately. Could be a thyroid problem, but if you base your decision as to treat somebody only on a TSH level, a lot of people are not going to be treated. Here's another one, no sex drive. That's a common complaint. More frequent infections. Here's another one that's making a lot of money for some people, sleep apnea. Maybe a thyroid condition instead of a lack of a CPAP machine.
So here's the situation. Dysfunctional thyroid, interrupted sleep, ultimately turning into sleep apnea, ultimately creating or being related to, I shouldn't say create, being related to irregular heartbeat, ultimately manifesting as possible some kind of really serious fibrillation, arrhythmia, poor oxygenation of the blood. You can see how this moves forward into really serious territory, but it's years and years and years of failing to acknowledge the underlying issue.
And a couple other common complaints, tinnitus, ringing in the ears. You know, we don't have a good treatment for that, but maybe somebody should suggest raising your thyroid hormone levels. Here's another point. The active thyroid hormone is T3, but you have to look at the free T3, not the total T3, to really know just how much your body is using. The minimum level in that is about 3.2 or 320, depending what how they're calculating that. So the upper end of the range is around 4. And the lower end of the range is about 2.7. Now, how did they come up with that? They took a bunch of people at random, and they found that this was the range. Some people might have been doing fine at 2.7. Other people might have been doing fine at 4. And now they're telling you, well, as long as you fall into that range, you're normal. Well, what if you're one of those people that need to be at 4 to feel good and not 2.7? You're going to not be treated. So there's a, you know, again, a real problem with using that test when you don't ask the patients how they feel. You got to use the two together. Now, one last thing that I wanted to point out is the effect of not making enough thyroid hormone or not making an effective thyroid hormone and cholesterol.
My thing with the clients that come to see me about their cholesterol numbers, I say, prior to the introduction of statin drugs, if your cholesterol was elevated, many times what the doctors would do is give you thyroid hormone replacement.
Well, this is something I just picked up at random as we were doing the program today. I just Googled it as I Googled.
So you were multitasking.
I was.
Okay,
I Googled
great.
Cholesterol and thyroid disease. So here's a published article that came up, The Effects of Thyroid Dysfunction on Lipid Profile. And the summary here says, thyroid dysfunction has a great impact on lipids. And lipids are fats in the blood, and cholesterol is one of those. So it has a great impact on lipids, as well as a number of other cardiovascular risk factors. Now, I'm going to set aside for a second. Broda Barnes, MD, wrote a book, Hypothyroidism, the Unsuspected Illness. And in that book, he explains how a low thyroid hormone, in other words, a dysfunctional thyroid, increases your risk of heart disease.
Right.
And the people with the highest levels are reducing the risk. So they go on to say in this article, though, hypothyroidism is relatively common and is associated with an unfavorable effect on lipids. Substitution therapy is beneficial for patients with overt hypothyroidism, improving lipid profile. However, whether subclinical hypothyroidism should be treated or not is a matter of debate. Well, you can decide. If the studies show that if you have higher thyroid hormone levels, not outside the range, but in the upper, the optimum range, lowers your risk of heart disease, you might decide, I want to be treated.
Dr. Slavin, is that treatment for hypothyroidism, would it be confined to simply replacing thyroid hormone, so hormone treatment? Or would you say that it's possible to start with certain nutritional supports like the amino acid tyrosine and possibly the trace mineral iodine?
Well, the answer is yes.
Okay.
In other words, all of the above. It really doesn't matter how you want to start approaching the problem as long as you do testing and get the desired response on the blood test report and on how the patient feels. Because after all, the goal is how the patient feels. You want to improve that. Now, if the patient says, hey, I feel fine, and you're just treating a lab number, then, you know, you can, you know, take the different approaches. I like just using thyroid hormone replacement because I can measure it. I know exactly what the patient is getting. But we started this topic because water fluoridation may cause hypothyroidism.
And you think about how ubiquitous fluoridated water is.
And the headline on this article is, water fluoridation at levels 20 times lower than EPA standards increases hypothyroidism.
Amazing.
That means we're all being exposed to levels of fluoride in the environment, in our water, that can cause hypothyroidism.
20 times the standard of the EPA.
And it's been my observation, since so many people have all those signs of hypothyroidism in normal blood tests, that when you substitute a fluoride for a iodine, because if you remember why when in high school you took chemistry and they gave you that periodic table of the elements, and you said, what do I need this for?
And you had to memorize things.
And but if you the one column there has the all the halogens, which start off with fluoride, and then you have chloride, and then you have iodine,
bromine
is in there too. So you have fluoride, chlorine, bromine, and then iodine. The one at the top, the fluoride, is the most active one. It will displace all the others. So you have fluoride displacing iodine, you have chlorine displacing iodine, you have bromine displacing iodine.
All of which we are exposed to.
Exactly. And here, but here's what I think, because this is what I've observed over 30 years of observing, is that it doesn't change the blood test, because the blood test is measuring a molecule. It's not measuring function. So remember, blood test is measuring the a thyroid hormone molecule. Well, thyroid hormone is made with several substances with iodine as the center element. So now you substitute fluoride instead of the iodine.
And it would never show on a blood test. It would
I don't think
say
the blood test makes that distinction.
Right. It would be T4, so right. Four molecules of one of the halogens, and T3, three molecules attached to that thyroid hormone.
The explanation for why people can have symptoms of hypothyroidism and still have a normal blood test is you're substituting fluoride or chlorine for the iodine. So you're making the hormone, but it's not a functional hormone. So you have symptoms of underactive thyroid with normal blood tests.
And your test shows that you're just fine. So this is where the art of medicine needs to be reintroduced into doctor's offices.
So how did they come up with this conclusion? So researchers compared hypothyroidism rates between two large populations with similar demographics. One of them used water fluoridation, which was done in England. So the Greater Manchester area did not have water fluoridation, while the other one did. And the other one was the Birmingham area. That one had fluoridation at the standard UK levels of one part per million. The analysis showed that rates of hypothyroidism were 94% higher in Birmingham than in the Manchester area. So where they
very interesting.
So the findings mean that in England alone, 15,000 people might be suffering from hypothyroidism as a result of water fluoridation. And that was reported in the Telegraph, which is a newspaper there. I can go back 25 years when I heard people talking about fluoride at my lectures when I went to ACAM, American College for Advancement of Medicine. I have to tell you, none of that was ever mentioned in medical school, that fluoride was a risk. And I'm hearing these speakers for the first time, and I'm saying, this is interesting stuff. Nobody's ever talked about it. And in this report we're referring to today, it says, although it's long been suspected that water fluoridation could cause hypothyroidism, the new study is the first. Believe it, I mean, after so many years, it's the first. And how come they didn't do it before they added the fluoride to the water? This is the first to ever look for such an effect in a large population. Indeed, a recent analysis of the health impacts of fluoridation in England, used as evidence to continue pronouncing the practice safe, failed to look at risks of hypothyroidism, even though the data for it were available.
Now, Dr. Slavin, the fluoride that is added to water is not identical to the naturally occurring fluoride that is found in water in certain areas of the world. The fluoride that is added to the water supposedly as a means of reducing cavities in children, that fluoride is also identified, the chemical structure of it is very, very different and is identified as a hazardous waste material. Now, I find it very difficult to believe that the chemists who decided that this is a good thing to add to water didn't have knowledge of the halogen placement in the periodic table of elements and didn't have knowledge of the potential dangers that they may have created. And here's the paranoid Janet again, thinking that it is, first of all, a government issue, that these governments, the municipal governments, are agreeing to add fluoride to the water, and the corporations that have produced this hazardous waste material, if there isn't a financial situation that we could possibly uncover. And as you often say, follow the money.
Well, actually, I think they probably thought, first of all, fluoride is an industrial waste product. So these companies had so much fluoride to dispose of, and they didn't know what to do with it. So they went to the municipality, say, "We're going to. How about if we dump it in your water system? It's going to be diluted so much that it's not even going. Nobody's going to even notice it, and we're going to pay it to do it too." And that's what happened. So the municipality said, "Oh yeah, we'll take the money, and since it's found in nature anyway, yeah, a little bit extra probably won't hurt." But we're finding out that's not true. So the recommendations right now is you have to reduce your exposure to fluoride. The dental field should stop relying on fluoride, whether you ingest it or apply it topically to the teeth to prevent dental cavities. Now, there have been studies to show that different demographic areas, fluoridated, not fluoridated, didn't have any difference in the incidence of dental cavities.
So right.
So this is another myth that's gone on.
Areas where fluoride is added to the water in people over the age of 65, the rate of hip fractures is higher.
That is true too, yes. But here's this is the one that's new information to me right now. In the same week that the British study was published, a study was also published in the journal Environmental Health on the risks of water fluoridation. This one found that U.S. states with higher rates of water fluoridation in 1992 had significantly higher rates of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in 2003, 2007, and 2011 after controlling for socioeconomic status. Therefore, parents reported higher rates of medically diagnosed ADHD in children in states in which a greater proportion of people receive fluoridated water from public water supplies, the researchers wrote. So one last point, Janet. So every 1% increase in the prevalence of fluoridation led to between 67,000 and 131,000 extra cases of ADHD. Now, was that new to you?
Okay, well, here's the kind of twist on that I know. Mothers who are seriously deficient in iodine have a much higher risk of giving birth to a baby, and I believe the neurological category is cretinism. So when we start to think about subclinical issues, it is not a stretch of your thought process to say, a little bit low iodine because of the exposure to fluoride will lead to babies being born that their neurological impairment would be much more slight than cretinism, and it would be possibly the Asperger's possibly ADHD and ADD.
No, I agree. So fluoridation definitely needs to be reconsidered in lieu of all this information that seems to be coming out, but not acknowledged publicly, because you don't hear it on the mainstream news anywhere that fluoride is bad. Again, it's big business, I think, controlling or censoring what the population knows. Right.
And the other part of it is when you attempt to remove fluoride from water, it's a very complicated issue. The filtering process is more than is generally used in, say, refrigerator water filters or those water filter pitchers or something like that. You need more significant filtering ability than what is generally available.
So to reiterate, water fluoridation at levels 20 times lower than EPA standards, in other words, it's in the perfectly safe range, according to the EPA, increases hypothyroidism, but it also increases the incidence of ADHD in children exposed to it. So I think that's a good take home. But one last thing I just want to point out, that chlorination, that's in the water you drink too, is going to have a similar effect.
Absolutely.
It's also in Splendor.
Three molecules of chlorine, right, bound to one molecule of sucrose,
right, it's
appropriately packaged,
right,
in yellow.
Yes. So, I mean, so we're really doing harm to our thyroid. So you really have to, doctors have to treat the patient and understand that these symptoms could be a thyroid problem, even if the lab tests don't reflect it. And how do you, so what do? You give patient thyroid if they feel better. You say, aha. They call that a therapeutic trial. You know, sometimes you have a hunch that this is what the patient needs. The lab tests don't necessarily confirm that. You try it anyway, and if the patient gets better, you've proved your point.
Very important information for our listeners, and I just want to remind them that they've been tuned to naturaldocradio.com. And I'm Janet Zimmerelli here with Dr. Herb Slavin. We are here with new information on a regular basis. Thanks for tuning in.